We're doing a procedure today called the central dogma, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to go through some biological basics, not only basics for genetics, but just really for all biology. But it's all related in one way or another to this central dogma. First of all, who can refresh the class's memory as to what the four biological macromolecules are that all organisms are made out of? Proteins, nucleic acids, lipids, and you said carbohydrates, which I'm not going to accept as a completely correct answer. The other three are correct. Lipids, yeah, polysaccharides is correct. You see the difference here? Carbohydrates is a more general word. It's a more all-encompassing word. By way of example, glucose, fructose, galactose, those are all carbohydrates. But none of them is a big molecule, and therefore it's not a macromolecule. So carbohydrates can be big or small. Those small ones are called monosaccharides, right? But to make a carbohydrate that's a macromolecule, you need to string together a bunch of monosaccharides to form a polysaccharide. So polysaccharides should be the fourth class, along with lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. Of those four, three of them are not only macromolecules, but they're officially classified as polymers, meaning that you build them by hooking together a bunch of monomers, or one-part subunits. Which one of those four is not actually a polymer? Which one? Nucleic acids are polymers, actually. Which one do you think is not?
Lipids.
Lipids are not. And they're smaller than the other two in general. I still consider them to be macromolecules. Some textbooks don't. But anyway, they are not polymers. They're built differently. The other three are polymers. And in fact, the word polysaccharide kind of points out that it's a polymer, right? Because it's made of many monosaccharides. The other two polymers, which are nucleic acids and proteins, can go by other names that also point out their polymer nature. By the way, why do we call nucleic acids nucleic acids? Did everyone hear that? Well, I didn't. When you interact with me, speak as loudly as I am speaking right now. Be proud of your answer, in other words.
I don't know if it's right.
That doesn't matter, though.
I said because they're found in the nucleus.
That's exactly right. Nucleic acids were named because, at least in a eukaryotic cell, which has a nucleus, that's where you find DNA, and DNA is a nucleic acid, right? Now, prokaryotic cells have DNA as well. They just don't have a nucleus. But anyway, that's why they got that name. You can call a nucleic acid something else, though, and that something else word tells you that it's a polymer. What's an alternative name for a nucleic acid, whether it's DNA or RNA? Well, what are the monomers that a nucleic acid is made out of? No, that's proteins. What is it? Nucleotides. And therefore, an alternative name for a nucleic acid is a polynucleotide. Tells you that it's a polymer. Proteins go by a second name as well that tells you that they're polymers. What's the alternative name for a protein? Well, that's a type of protein, but I mean any given protein can be called something else. Polypeptide, exactly. Not because a protein is made up of peptides, it's actually made up of amino acids, right? But any pair of adjacent amino acids in the overall protein are hooked together covalently by a peptide bond. So when you have a string of many amino acids, you have many peptide bonds, that's why they get the name. Actually, though, the word polypeptide and the word protein aren't completely interchangeable. They're interchangeable. Sometimes there's a slight difference. Anyone know the condition under which the words protein and polypeptide mean different things, slightly at least? No, because all polypeptides will be folded in order to have their function, folded in some way at least, even a fibrous protein. Okay, well, think back to the levels of protein structure. How many levels of protein structure are there? 4, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, right? First, second, third, and fourth is really all that means. Well, any protein has at least the first 3. Only certain proteins have quaternary structure. What kind of proteins? What is quaternary structure, in other words?
Basically, multiple proteins are linking it's linking multiple proteins together to make an entire unit.
Multiple polypeptides.
Yes.
Yeah, there are some proteins called multimeric proteins, and multimeric is really just another way of saying polymeric. Polymer means many parts, so does multimer. But a multimeric protein is a protein that's made out of more than one polypeptide that remain polypeptides in their own right, but they come together some way to form the bigger structure that we call a protein. Okay? So in that case, for a quaternary protein or a multimeric protein, the word polypeptide and the word protein mean different things because polypeptide really refers to just part of the overall protein. But for the rest of the proteins in the world, the ones that are just made of one polypeptide, the word polypeptide and the word protein are, in that case, interchangeable. Does that all make sense? Okay. Well, nucleic acids and proteins are relevant to today's procedure, which is about the central dogma. But before we get to the actual dogma, let's just talk about DNA for a second. First of all, a DNA, what we call a DNA molecule, is really two molecules. It's two, since DNA is double-stranded, whereas RNA is usually single-stranded, a DNA double-stranded entity is really two separate polynucleotides, right? But they are attached to each other by hydrogen bonding that keeps the two strands together. So we tend to use the word or the phrase DNA molecule. Really, it's two separate molecules hooked together. Anyway, one whole double-stranded DNA occurs in what structure? When you throw it, well, no, yes, it occurs inside the nucleus. But what do we call the structure that contains one whole DNA? A chromosome, exactly, along with histone proteins, if we're talking about a eukaryotic cell, which we usually are. So that tremendously long sequence of nucleotides in a chromosome, millions of nucleotides long, that's just a sequence of nucleotides, right? Which come in 4 varieties, right? A, C, T, and G. Well, that DNA has two major functions, two processes that directly involves DNA. What are those two processes? Transcription is one, translation is not one. DNA is not directly involved in translation. It's not involved at all in translation. What's that?
RNA
is involved in translation, but we're talking about DNA. So yes, one of its jobs is transcription. What's the other one?
Replication.
And those are important at different times in the cell cycle. Replication really isn't about doing anything for that cell's own lifetime. You know, a cell has a certain lifetime, that ends either if the cell gets killed somehow or when the cell makes the decision to split into two brand new cells. That's what replication is for, right? When a cell is about ready to end its own life, in a sense, in order to split to become two brand new cells, that's when replication has to occur so that those two daughter cells each have a full complement of DNA to live. They need to have a full library. Transcription, on the other hand, is all about what's happening during the lifetime of that cell. Now, what is it that gets transcribed? What are the structural units that get transcribed? It's not the chromosome that gets transcribed. What is it? It's not even an entire strand that gets transcribed. In fact, it's very little of the strand because most of those nucleotides do not stand as a code for anything. So what is the functional unit? What's the name of the functional unit that actually gets transcribed? A gene, exactly. So a given chromosome with its millions of nucleotides long is mostly non-coding DNA. It doesn't stand for a code for how to make something. Here and there, though, there are little stretches, little subsequences within the overall sequences that we call a gene. And that's what does get transcribed. Now, in all cases, what is the product of transcription? What gets produced in all cases of transcription? RNA. You correctly answer that. Usually I trap people and they will say messenger RNA, which is not true for all cases. Sometimes transcription does produce messenger RNA. That's when we're talking about specifically genes that are called protein coding genes. A protein coding gene doesn't directly code for how to make a protein, but it does so indirectly. It codes for how to make messenger RNA. DNA's job is done, transcription's over. Messenger RNA is now carrying that code, and it can link up with a ribosome and assemble amino acid at a time, the correct sequence to make that polypeptide. Okay, so those are called protein coding genes. The vast majority of your 20,000 or so genes are protein coding genes. But there are also genes, and therefore coding entities, that are called non-protein coding genes. What do non-protein coding genes code for?
Non-proteins.
Well, all genes code for non-proteins because we just said that all genes are transcribed into RNA. And so in a sense, you've already answered the question. What is the answer explicitly, though? What do these non-protein coding genes code for?
RNA.
What kind? All the other kinds of RNA besides messenger RNA. tRNA, snRNA, rRNA. There's all kinds of different RNA types. Well, each of those RNA types are specific sequences of RNA nucleotides. Those don't just pop into existence. They have to be built according to an instruction. The instructions for how to build those other kinds of RNA besides messenger RNA are found in the non-protein coding genes. That's how your cell knows how to make ribosomal RNA, for instance, to package them together to make a ribosome. Okay? So, now let's finally get to the central dogma. The central dogma is really about flow of information. Nucleic acids are informational molecules. They convey information. And the central dogma can be written in schematic form just by saying that you start with DNA, that holds information, and then use an arrow to convey that that information is being transferred to RNA, and then information flows from RNA finally to a polypeptide. All right? If I write it that way, what does that first or left arrow represent? What process?
Transcription.
Yeah, that's transcription. And the second arrow is translation, right? Translation is when the actual polypeptide is assembled. Well, that's not the complete schematic representation, but right away you can see one of DNA's two jobs. Transcription is something DNA is directly involved in. The other one, remember, was self-replication. So you can represent that by a circular arrow that goes from DNA back to itself. So that completes DNA's two major functions. And we could leave it as is. In fact, when Watson and Crick came up with this central dogma, they said this is the way information always flows. It turned out being wrong about that. That happens often in science, and the nice thing is that we readjust the facts. We don't just stick to those. It is true that information usually flows from DNA to RNA and then from RNA to proteins or polypeptides. But there's an exception, because under certain instances, a cell can use RNA as a template for how to build DNA. So we could make this a double arrow. If that happens, if the information flows from RNA to DNA, what do we call that process? Well, the hint is that it's just the reverse as the transcription. It's called reverse transcription, yes. So that requires a special enzyme called reverse transcriptase, but it's possible for cells to do that under certain instances. So that's the central dogma in schematic form. And that's really what you're modeling today when you do your when you play around with your beads and pipe cleaners and straws. I'm not quite done though, so let's go to a picture that summarizes protein synthesis. Protein synthesis exists in two steps: transcription first and then translation. Right? You need to start with DNA, transcribe that code into a messenger RNA. That is what transcription is. And then once that's done, you can use the RNA itself as a code for how to build the protein. That is translation. So the DNA, of course, is double-stranded, the blue thing here. And DNA is not only double-stranded, but the two strands are arranged in an anti-parallel nature, meaning head-to-toe, basically, with respect to 3' and 5' end. And they're also complementary, right? Strictly complementary. T always with A and C always with G. So this little chunk of DNA represents at least part of a gene. If it weren't a gene, it wouldn't be being transcribed. In any case, any gene, of course, being DNA, has two strands, but only one of those two strands is going to be used as a template. This is different from DNA replication. In DNA replication, you separate the two strands, and each one serves as a template for how to build a copy of the other one. Right? In transcription, you really only read the code in one of the strands. And there's some confusing terminology here, because we call one of those strands the template strand. That's the one that's labeled. The other one, whichever one is not the template strand, is called the coding strand. And the reason that's potentially confusing is that calling it the coding strand kind of implies that it's the one that gets read and is used. It's not. It's the one that just gets separated from the template strand and hangs out. But we call it the coding strand for good reason. It's just important to understand why. Template strand and coding strand are obviously complementary to each other, right? That is obvious to you? All right. The template strand is the one that actually gets read by the enzyme. What enzyme are we talking about in transcription? What kind? It's RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase is the thing that reads the code in the DNA and assembles the messenger RNA one RNA nucleotide at a time. So it does that by reading the template strand. And when it, just like in replication, which would be DNA polymerase, when it reads the the code in the original strand, it assembles a complementary strand, right? So that means when RNA polymerase produces messenger RNA by reading the template strand, that messenger RNA is going to be complementary to the template strand. The only difference here is that it uses uracil instead of thymine. So if you have an A in the original code, instead of being T in the messenger RNA, it's going to be a U. Otherwise, it's complementary to it, though, right? Well, since the non-template strand is complementary to the template strand, and the messenger RNA is complementary to the template strand, that means the messenger RNA is pretty much like that non-template strand, except for U's instead of T's. That's why we call it the coding strand. The code that we're producing is really just like the strand that we're not using. Does that make sense? Okay, I just wanted to make sure you understand that terminology. Now, when it comes time to transcribe the gene, this is done on a nucleotide-by-nucleotide basis. There's a one-to-one relationship in transcription, meaning that one nucleotide at a time is read, and then by the laws of strict complementarity, the cell knows which RNA nucleotide to put down next. All right? And that can be a one-to-one relationship because there are four kinds of normal DNA nucleotides, and there are also four kinds of normal RNA nucleotides, right? It's not the same four, but it's a four-to-four relationship. The simplest case when it comes to translation, and therefore the case that would have been favored by evolution, would have been for there to be a one-to-one correspondence between nucleotides and amino acids. This can't happen, though. And the reason that can happen is simple mathematical reason. There are four kinds of RNA nucleotides, but there are 20 kinds of biological amino acids. And so you don't have enough nucleotides for each one to individually stand for its own amino acid. By the way, before I forget, let's quickly talk about the words transcription and translation, which can be confusable if you don't really think about words. And I want you to actually think about words, especially in biology, it's very helpful. So don't just think of words as random collection of symbols. They have meaning. If you think they're just random collection of symbols, it's like memorizing phone numbers from a phone book. It'd be very difficult. Think about what these words mean in everyday life. Transcription refers to rewriting something. For instance, you can transcribe the recording I'm making right now. This recording is made in English. To transcribe it would be to write it down in English. You're not changing the language, you're just rewriting it. This is why they chose to call this transcription in the cell, because you're staying within the language of nucleotides when you go from DNA to RNA. Slightly different dialect, but it's the same language. Okay? On the other hand, the word translation does refer to a language change, and that's appropriate here because in translation, you're going from the language of nucleotides to the language of amino acids. And so it is a language change. But back to this problem of having only four nucleotide types versus 20 amino acid types. This is why you can't have just one nucleotide represent one amino acid. Therefore, you have to use more than one nucleotide to represent a single amino acid. Now, if you used a sequence of two nucleotides, a doublet, how many possibilities would there be? How many possible combinations of a string of two nucleotides, each of which has four possibilities, are there? 16, because there's four choices for that first position, and for each of those four, there's also four for the second one, so it's 4 times 4. Well, 16 is still fewer than 20, so that is not enough, and therefore it wouldn't have worked evolutionarily. The bare minimum that it can be in order to specify all 20 biological amino acids is a sequence of 3, and that's why evolution worked on that. Parsimoniously. It's the simplest solution. Well, how many combinations are there for a string of 3? A triplet, in other words. which we call a codon in messenger RNA. How many possibilities are there? Not 24, a little low. It's the same mathematical process, right? You have 4 for the first choice. For each of those, you have 4 for the second, so that's 16. For each of those 16 combinations, you have 4 for the next one. So it's 64 totals. 4 times 4 times 4, 4 cubed. So there are 64 codons in the genetic code. And I say it that way, stressing the word the, because it's a universal genetic code. With almost no exceptions, every organism that's ever existed has used the same genetic code. Bit of strong evidence pointing to the fact that we all come from that original cell. A couple exceptions evolved later on, but very few. Anyway, there are 64 codons in the genetic code, and that's way more than 20. So it's certainly enough to specify all 20 amino acids, but you have more than you need to specify all 20. This brings up the notion that the genetic code has two important properties. One is that it is redundant. The other is that it is non-ambiguous. So redundancy refers to repetitiveness, right? This is simply a matter of, it comes straight from the fact that 64 is greater than 20. Since you have more codons than you need to specify all 20 amino acids, some amino acids can be specified by more than one codon. This is completely analogous to synonyms in language. There's many different words for expressing good, for instance. You can say it a lot of different ways. You don't have to use the word good. But the meaning is the same. Similarly, if lysine is the amino acid that needs to be put down next, multiple different codons could be used and they all will specify lysine. That's redundancy. On the other hand, it's not ambiguous, the genetic code. But let's talk about what it would mean to be ambiguous. What does that word mean in everyday language? Right, because ambiguous means that there are multiple possible meanings. And so a linguistic example is if I use the phrase, I'm hot. I can mean that my temperature is elevated. I can mean that I'm a currently very popular celebrity. Or I could be very angry. Or the one that you would get from context is, I'm sexually attractive. The phrase I'm hot could mean, and it would just depend. Well, you wouldn't want that to be the case in translation. If the genetic code were ambiguous, that would mean a codon one time would specify a certain amino acid, and that same codon a different time would specify another amino acid, and you'd end up making the wrong protein. That would be bad. It'd be lethal. So, despite the redundancy, there is non-ambiguity in the genetic code. Okay? That brings us then finally to what you're actually doing. First, before you play around with your toys, you're going to have to do a little written exercise to model the transcription part of the central dogma. And so you're going to be given a sequence of nucleotides that is labeled as the template strand. And the template transcription always occurs by reading the template strand from 3' to 5'. When you produce the messenger RNA, since it's anti-parallel, that means the mRNA would be produced in the 5' to 3' direction, right? And that's how you always need to read mRNA. No matter how it's written, look for the 5' end, and that's the end you start reading it from. It's easiest to read left to right if that's the way you read, which most of us do. But if you happen to have it written the other way, you're always reading from the 5' end of the mRNA. Anyway, you're writing down, you're just using complementarity rules to write down the messenger RNA code. Then you need to find the start codon, and that's what sets the frame, right? From there on, you just look up each codon in the genetic code and figure out what the corresponding amino acid is. And that will let you to write down a sequence of amino acids that will allow you to actually build the model protein or polypeptide. You do that by stringing together beads on a pipe cleaner. The pipe cleaner just holds it together. The beads themselves represent what? The amino acids. And between adjacent beads will be little sections of drinking straw. What do those represent? Peptide bonds, exactly. So your DNA and your mRNA, both nucleic acids, have 3' and 5' ends. Your protein doesn't. There's no 3' and 5' end to the polypeptide. Instead, there's a C-terminus and an N-terminus, but you don't have to worry about those today. Just remember that they don't have 3' and 5' end. I've said enough, I think, so just go ahead and do it. You're going to be doing basically the same thing three times. You're going to make a wild-type protein based on the original DNA, and then you're going to mutate that DNA twice by your choosing and go through with the same process again to form two new ones. So when you, I should mention that when it comes time to folding it up, you basically, the colors don't represent individual amino acids. They represent the chemistry of the amino acids, and that's important to how it actually folds up. So you, here's where hydrophobic and hydrophilic come into play. Hydrophilic things don't mind being around water, right? Which is also polar. Hydrophilic things are polar. Hydrophobic things don't want to be around don't want to be around polar things. So this is largely determines how a polypeptide, once it's sequenced, will fold up into three dimensions and therefore have its function. It folds up in such a way that as much as possible, the hydrophobic amino acids will be toward the interior of that glob, and the hydrophilic ones will be on the surface because they don't mind being around the surrounding water. One thing I wanted to say that I just reminded myself of. Oh, no, I lost it again. What is it that allows for there to be different kinds of amino acids? What is the only thing that makes amino acids different from other amino acids? That's what makes nucleotides different from each other. Well, really, we always talk about 20 amino acids in biology. There's no limit to the number of amino acid types that you could make in a laboratory. Because to be an amino acid, you have to have a central carbon atom that's connected to four things. If three of those things are a hydrogen atom, a carboxyl group, and an amino group, then you have an amino acid, regardless of what the fourth slot is. That's the variable part. That's why there are different kinds of amino acids. We call that the R group. Well, what that R group is what gives that individual amino acid its chemical properties. And so that's what determines whether it's hydrophilic or hydrophobic. And that, in turn, is going to determine how it folds up into three dimensions. So now I'll let you loose.